Good morning, and thanks again for joining us at Beit Midrash Zichron Zohar for our Yarchei Kalah, our family day Yarchei Kalah. A brief word about who we are and what our role in the community. Here at Beit Midrash Zichron Zohar, meaning I, Rav Tarach Shinera, Rosh Beit Midrash, of Alex, Rechaim Metzger, and Rabbi Natanael Klein, are each stationed in different parts of the greater Toronto community. And we're here to teach Torah and engage the community in Torah learning, and to help enhance the spirituality and religious lives of everybody in the Toronto community as much as we can. So thank you so much for joining us. And specifically, aside from the shiurim and programs you run throughout the Toronto community, such as business ethics lectures and medical ethics lectures and lectures of all shapes, sizes, and colors, in the morning we are engaged in Torah learning and in learning Gemara B'Iyun, Talmud in depth. And this year, we've been learning about the laws of Shemitah, as it is the Shemitah year next year. And we are happy to give you a taste of our experience in the Beit Midrash, or at least the virtual Beit Midrash, that we have every single day, in terms of not just getting to the bottom line of what you should and should not do, but to understand the concepts and the depth and analysis behind those conclusions, and why we don't do or do what we do. It's really a pleasure to learn with everyone this morning. So our topic for today is the topic of the heter mechira, which means the heter means dispensation or allowance, the allowance of selling parts of the land of Israel during the Shemitah year to non-Jews in order to allow the owners of those lands or farmers to, at least in some capacity, work the land, harvest their produce, and sell it so that they can get by and make a living. So before we get to the specifics and of that dispensation, let me pose the following question to you. And I think it's a basic one, but I think it's important to sort of discuss. So I think you've seen, the heter mechira is quite controversial. Every single aspect of it is subject to dispute. So why do we do this? Why do we go about enacting this controversial dispensation in order to allow people to not keep Shemitah as it's described in the Torah? What's the motivation? Why is this necessary? And you may think, yeah.
Are you asking, Rabbi?
Yes, I am. I am asking.
Because nothing in life is so easy.
Okay, and what's not easy about this? About Shemitah specifically. This is not a complicated question. You can reference sources 1 to 4.
Money, giving up on a full multiple years worth of gross is way too much.
Right. So if you looked at source number 1 to 4, as Rabbi Metzger referenced, in a Shemitah year, as the Torah would have it, and as the rabbis would have it, think about what a farmer, and for that matter, a vendor can't do. So number one, as we see in source number one, we'll read just the first line here. The Rambam says in the laws of Shemitah, chapter 1, it is a positive commandment to refrain from working the land and caring for trees in the seventh year. As it says, the land shall rest a Sabbath for the Lord. And it says, in plowing and in harvesting, you shall rest. Meaning, you can't do generally, you shouldn't work your land during Shemitah at all. Now, there's obviously complexity to that. What constitutes working the land? What constitutes a biblical prohibition of working the land? What's just a rabbinic prohibition? Those are all interesting discussions. We've been learning about that throughout the year here in the Beit Midrash, and I gave you a reference to some of the shiurim that we've given. But generally, working the land is not allowed. So that's number one. But it's not just that. Additionally, rabbinically, as the Rambam describes in source number 2, most of the produce, even the produce that grows by itself, cannot be consumed during Shemitah year. Even if you have good luck, and all of a sudden, even if you don't grow the land, there's a tremendous amount of produce that grows by itself. You can't eat that, or most of it. You can't eat most typical produce that grows during the Shemitah year, because the rabbis were afraid that if we allowed people to eat produce that grows by itself, people may rig the system They're going to pretend that it grew by itself, but ultimately they'll secretly work the land and violate the law of making the land rest during Shemitah, and therefore they forbid even produce that grows by itself. So not only can't you work the land, you also can't even eat most of the produce, and that is not all. Because it's not just that you can't work the land or eat the produce, you can't sell it to others either. Because produce during the Shemitah year has what we call Kedushat Shvi'it, the sanctity of the Shemitah year. Let me just put the source sheet in the chat for those who may not have it. Sorry about that. Here, 1 second, please. I'm just going to copy my link from over here. Okay. Hopefully everyone should be able to access that now. At produce during Shemitah year, it has Kedushat Shvi'it, Shvi'it sanctity, which means that you're not allowed to do whatever you like with it. You can't throw it out, as you may know. You can't use it abnormally. And maybe most importantly for all purposes, you can't sell it normally for a profit. So imagine that you're a farmer in the land of Israel, and now you keep Shemitah year. Can't work your land, can't harvest your produce normally, and you can't sell it. This is a problem. And hence, one of the ways to address this issue is what we call the Heter Mechira. And as Rav Kook describes in source number 4, this dispensation is based on the notion that, number one, nowadays, there is no longer a biblical commandment to observe the laws of Shemitah, such as abstaining from working the land. That prohibition against working the land during Shemitah is rabbinic. And therefore, we can rely on the opinions who hold that when you sell the land of Israel to a non-Jew, to some extent, the sanctity of that land is removed. And therefore, the prohibitions and the mitzvot associated with Shemitah, which make life difficult for farmers, no longer apply. Now, let me just add one more thing regarding this sale, and then we'll get to some of the complications and the hashkafic issues behind it. So when we talk about the Heter Mechira as it is nowadays, it's a bit different than it was originally. So as you may know, already in the 1500s and 1600s, Jews began settling in parts of Israel and Safat, and they ran into some issues, as we're describing, with observing the land of Shemitah. Already in those times, the times of Rabbi Yosef Karo, the times of Rabbi Moshe Detrani, there was a notion of selling the land during Shemitah. However, in those times, selling the land during Shemitah meant selling it for the year, allowing the non-Jews to basically possess it for that year, and then the sale would be a temporary sale, and it would return to Jewish owners. Nowadays, that's not what we mean when we describe the Heter Mechira. When we sell the land during Shemitah nowadays, for the most part, we are not allowing the non-Jews to use it as if they were owners. Rather, we legally sell it to them, but for most practical purposes, the farmers who own the land continue working the land and harvesting and selling the produce for the most part. So it's not only is that there a controversy in terms of selling the land, it's that the whole sale is really for legal purposes only. Practically, the non-Jew is not going to hold on to this land. And this raises all sorts of issues. So, before we get to some of the specifics halachically, what are some of the philosophical issues or philosophical arguments against Heter Mechira? If you want to reference sources number 5 through 8, the Ritvaz, Yaakov Volosky, and Natalia Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, what are the hashkafic problems with this notion of selling the land of Israel? What do you think? I think most of us got up to source number 5. What does the Ritvaz say from Yaakov Volosky? What's his argument against Heter Mechira, selling the land of Israel?
Well, I don't have that, Rabbi, but my guess is you're selling it to a non-Jew, right?
Okay.
Well, yeah. the land of Israel is the land of Jewish people. Should you have a non-Jew having a piece of the milk and honey that the Jews were promised?
Right. 100%. So there's a, first of all, just legally, there's a prohibition against doing so. And even halachically, why are we giving up the land of Israel to non-Jews? The way it works nowadays, I'm not quite as concerned about the halachic issue simply because we're not really giving it up to, allowing non-Jews to inhabit it as if we didn't exist, right? We're really, for most intents and purposes, holding on to the land.
Although it's temporary.
But I hear what you're saying. It's 100% a concern. So I actually, Rabbi Yaakov Volovsky, the Ritvaz, I love reading the Ritvaz because he has an extensive commentary on the Yerushalmi and on these issues because he was living them. Again, during the 20th century, the rabbis who lived in Israel were dealing with these issues in real time. And what he says is that I don't understand Yerushalmi. I don't get it. Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, as we'll read throughout the lecture today, was one of the main rabbis who supported this notion of the Heter Mechira. And he says, I don't get it, Rav Cook. Why are you doing this Heter Mechira? What's the point of doing this? You're telling me because Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. There's a mitzvah to live in the land of Israel. Beautiful. I understand that. But what's the whole basis of the dispensation here? The whole basis of your allowance to sell the land of Israel and allow people to then work the land is based on the notion that when you sell the land of Israel to a non-Jew, the land loses its sanctity such that, Rabbi Yaakov Volovsky claims, it's as if it's no longer Eretz Yisrael. It's Chutz La'aretz, it's land outside of Israel, and therefore the laws of Shemitah no longer apply. That's why you are being lenient here. So how can you tell me on the one hand, says Rabbi Yaakov Volovsky, that you want to allow people to fulfill the mitzvah of living in the land of Israel, and then in the same breath say, and the way that they're going to do that is by selling the land of Israel to non-Jews such that it's no longer holy. That makes absolutely no sense. Take a look here at source number 5. I'll read the English for interest of time, though my translation is far from perfect. The entire dispensation is only according to the opinion of the Beit Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Karo. And if you want to learn more about this notion of selling the land to non-Jews and thereby removing it from its Kedusha, we talked about this on Friday. And you can reference the link that I have on the source sheet to our shirim. However, the whole dispensation is according to the opinion of the Beit Yosef, who holds the sabbatical year doesn't apply to non-Jewish produce. That's your whole heter. His entire reason is because he holds that non-Jews can make acquisitions in the land of Israel to uproot its sanctity. According to this, since the sanctity is uprooted by non-Jews, how is it relevant to say the rabbis didn't decree when it conflicts with setting the land of Israel such that they nullify the laws of the rabbis to settle the land of Israel? What you're saying is that the rabbis made laws, but the rabbis say you don't have to keep those laws so that you can live in Israel, and they therefore allow you to remove the sanctity of the land of Israel. Why would they allow you to remove the sanctity of the land of Israel so that you can live in Israel? It just doesn't make any sense. This is Rabbi Yaakov Volovsky's argument against Heter Mechira on a hashkafic level. So how do we respond to this argument? Or how does Rav Cook respond to this argument by Rav Yaakov Volovsky that how can you tell me that you want people to live in Israel and therefore you're going to sell the land and remove its Kedusha, its sanctity? So Rav Cook actually has a beautiful comparison between settling in the land of Israel and learning Torah. I think it's instructive in terms of the goals behind learning Torah, and also instructive in terms of how we understand the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. Rav Cook says, learning Torah, yes, certainly does enhance observance of halacha, enhance mitzvah performance. That's certainly true. But that's not the only goal of Torah study, right? And even if those of us learning Torah right now about the laws of Eretz Yisrael don't live in Eretz Yisrael, that doesn't take away from the value of our learning. Because learning Torah is an end unto itself. It is a holy endeavor. It's learning the ratzon, the will, and the wisdom of God. even if you can't practically apply it, even if you learn laws about the temple or laws that are no longer applicable, that doesn't take away from the value of Torah study. So too, says Rav Kook, living in the land of Israel isn't totally contingent upon keeping the mitzvot associated with the land of Israel. Meaning, says Rav Kook, even if you're right, and unfortunately we had to relieve Eretz Yisrael of some of its sanctity and thereby exempt those who live in it from keeping the mitzvot tliya ba'aretz, that doesn't mean Eretz Yisrael is no longer holy, and it doesn't mean that Eretz Yisrael, there's no longer a mitzvah and there's no longer great value to living in the land of Israel. That what we mean when we say that when you sell the land to Gentiles, it uproots some of its sanctity, is not that it's no longer holy. It means it loses a certain level of sanctity. But in terms of the preciousness of the land, the fact that it's Eretz Asher Hashem Lokecha, Ani Hashem Lokecha Doresh Ota, the land that God is constantly seeking its welfare, that remains even absent certain mitzvot. And therefore, the fact that we had to sell the land of Israel to allow people to live in it doesn't mean that it no longer is valuable to encourage people to live in it. And in fact, the Cook doubles down this in source number 8. And this is a response to the Netziv, and then I want to stop for a second to take questions to make sure you're still with me here. So the Netziv says in source number 7, another really important issue, which is as follows. And Talmud Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, a Rosh Yeshiva in 19th century Lithuania, says as follows. Wait a second. I don't get it. You know, the Torah also thought about this problem, right? So we've been talking about how difficult it is to keep Shemitah. The thing is, the Torah knows it's difficult to keep Shemitah. Not like Gashem doesn't realize that if you don't farm the land for a whole entire year, it's going to cause difficulty. Of course he realizes that. And yet, Hashem tells us to keep the land, the laws of Shemitah. And the point is, says from the Talmud Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, that the Eretz Yisrael is not governed by natural law. Eretz Yisrael is the success of our maintenance, the land of Israel, is contingent upon our observance of the mitzvot. It's beyond nature. Just as the fate of the Jewish people is beyond nature, so too the fate of the land of Israel is beyond nature. It's reliant on God's divine providence. And only if we properly keep the mitzvot will we be able to successfully settle the land of Israel. So Rav Kook, how can you tell me that you are encouraging people to live in Israel and thereby telling them not to keep the laws? That makes no sense. The only way they'll be successful is by keeping the laws. This is what Hashem promises. He promises us a bracha, a blessing. To which Rav Kook responds, I believe in source 8 as follows. Okay, take a look at source number 8. The purpose of the settlement is a matter of generations. And by strengthening the Yishuv and the culture of our brothers, the house of Israel and the Holy Land, there will be redemption soon. Point one, Rav Kook says, you have to look at this with a long-term perspective. Yes, right now, you're right. Right now, we have to encounter certain prohibitions. But in the long scheme of things, in the great scheme of things, it's better for the Jewish people to return to Israel because that will bring the ultimate redemption, and that will allow us to appropriately observe the laws of Shemitah. We need to get people there first, and then we can worry about all these specifics. But if no one's there, it's not going to happen. Because it is obvious that redemption depends on an abundance of our brethren, the holy nation, in the Holy Land. And ultimately, we will merit to fulfill everything. And he has a very interesting parallel based on the Gemara in Yoma, which says that to save someone's life on Shabbos, you can violate Shabbos, because violate one Shabbat in order to allow them to keep many Shabbatot in the future. So too, we have to not really violate, but avoid certain restrictions now to allow the future and present even settlement of the land of Israel so that we can ultimately experience a true redemption and fully observe all of the laws. So Hashkafically, therefore, I think we have two very important distinctions or arguments here. Number one, how do we look at the holy list of the land of Israel? Is it simply a means to an end? Do we say that if you can't keep mitzvot, there is no holy list, or no? The holy list of the land of Israel is independent from the specific observance of these halachot. And also, what do we do about those Jews who are struggling to live in the land of Israel because of these requirements? Do we double down and say, no, this is what the Torah says? The only way we'll be successful is if we keep all the laws as described, or no? Rav Kook, as I was discussing with Rav Netanel before Seder, Rav Kook loves the land of Israel, but he also loves the Jewish people. And he wants the Jewish people to feel connected to the land of Israel and feel like they can return. And so as Rabbi Tarchiner described beforehand, for Rav Kook, there is a notion of Yeridah L'Tzorech Aliyah, of allowing certain decisions that are not ideal to ultimately achieve the ideal. That's what galut, that's what exile is about, that we weren't ready to live in the land of Israel, and therefore we had to have periods where we couldn't do so. And if that's necessary now to not fully observe the laws of Shemitah, so then that's what we'll have to do to allow this to happen. Okay. Any questions or comments? I think I was
I have a comment, Rabbi. I mean, to be honest with you, when I hear Rav Kook talking about, well, you know, Mashiach, it'll be coming, that I don't like. Don't tell me Mashiach is going to be coming soon, because Mashiach ain't here, and that was 100 years ago. So Mashiach ain't coming soon. So he's off there. But as far as the 30,000-foot view here, this is about Emunah. That's it. You have Emunah, you'll be taken care of. The land of Israel was holy before the Jews got there.
It was exactly. The land. You're a disciple of the Nitziv. I think that's great. You're arguing for the Nitziv over here. The Talit Yehuda Berlin. I love that. And I think there's a lot of truth to it. Unfortunately, some people aren't on that level of Emunah. And I think pragmatics are important here. Cook is saying, look, we can talk about bracha, 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 emunah, emunah, emunah. Practically, there are going to be people in the land of Israel who are going to say, I don't see no bracha. I'm working the land. Sorry, rabbis. And so there's also a sort of question in terms of psak here. What do we do when there are going to be people who aren't going to keep the halacha as we would like? Do we say, look, tough on them, the halacha is halacha, or do we find potential avenues to allow them to have a connection to the laws of Shemitah as well? So I think that it relates to that question as well. Unfortunately, not everyone has this incredible faith. And you know, I think I would add, and this is a longer discussion and we have a limited amount of time here, but this notion of that described in the Torah of Hashem providing the bracha to Eretz Yisrael is not, it's not 100% clear that that is always present. And there are opinions you say that we only are guaranteed this bracha if, number one, Shemitah is still applicable in all its breadth and glory, and it's still a biblical prohibition when the Jewish people live in Israel. But when we don't have all the Jewish people living in Israel in the appropriate portions, it isn't the bracha. We can't rely on it. And I think generally this reliance on divine providence assumes that we're doing everything right. You know, and like if we're keeping Shemitah and we're doing our part, then, you know, the Torah says Hashem's going to watch out for you. But even if we try, there's a certain, you know, presumption that we're getting everything right. We're not violating, you know, we know when Shemitah is, which is also a question, and we got the right year. These are all questions that relate to this sort of emunah that you talk about. And I think they're also relevant for discussion.
Could I ask?
Yeah.
It's my understanding, and maybe wrong, almost all the land in Israel is not owned privately. It's owned by the state, the government of Israel. So what we talk about here, the right to sell land or not sell land, a farmer isn't selling his land. It's not his land to start with.
Right.
So like, right. How does the impact that you have a state of Israel, which is a secular state, if you want to call it, now, Jews, non-Jews are citizens. I'm not quite sure.
It's a great point. I sort of want to get to that a bit later when we get to the discussion of Arnona, but it's a great point. To answer simply for now, it would require, I mean, it relates to who the prohibition, who is prohibited to work the land, just the owners of the land or even just anybody. But what we'd be saying then is that the government is sort of selling the land. That's who's doing the sale. So, but there are other issues also related to when the government owns the land and whether or not we should still apply the same rules. I hope to get to that in just a few minutes. That's okay.
Okay.
Thanks for your point. So let's move on to the problem of selling the land of Israel to a non-Jewish population. Okay, so if you look at source number 9, the Torah relates to how we are meant to enter the land of Israel. And the purpose of entering the land of Israel is to set up a holy society of worshipers of God, who therefore are citizens of his holy land. And hence, we don't have much tolerance for idolatrous behavior in the land of Israel. And therefore, we cannot sell the land to people who won't abide by our code of conduct. Obviously, that's a very loaded statement I just said, and we could talk, you know, for hours about whether it's okay to sell the land of Israel nowadays for peace and things of that nature. We have shiurim about that on YU Torah. I don't want to get into that now for purposes of time. But that being said, if you look at source number 10, the Talmud codifies a rule against selling the land of Israel to non-Jews. Says the Gemara in source number 10, Tananami Haki, Lo Tichanim, Lo Titain Lahem Chanaya Bekarka. The first explanation of the word Lo Tichanim, thou shalt not show them favor, means do not, that's how I would translate it, but the word Chain can also relate to the word Chanaya, which means encampment, dwelling. And the Chazal, the sages, saw in that phrase a prohibition against allowing non-Jews or maybe idolatrous non-Jews the ability to live in the land of Israel. Okay, so that's a problem. So again, what our whole basis of our dispensation is that we are selling the land of Israel to non-Jews. If it is indeed prohibited to sell the land of Israel to non-Jews, well, then we run into a number of issues.
Who's doing who the favor? We're not doing them a favor.
Great point. Thank you, Jeffrey. So I actually didn't mention this because there's just so many issues to talk about. And again, we already only have a half an hour left. But Jeffrey mentions that, wait, who is doing who the favor? Maybe you can sort of relate this notion of giving them encampment in the land, the notion of giving them a favor. And the whole prohibition only exists if you're doing it for their benefit, to benefit them. But if we're interested in selling them the land so that we aren't bound by the prohibitions against working land during Shemitah, then maybe the prohibition doesn't apply. That is indeed one of the arguments for leniency in regard to this prohibition. Rav Kook mentions that argument as well. By 30 sources, I thought was enough for 1 hour, but if we had more time, I would have put that on there also. But that issue also is disputed by the Chazon Ish, as we'll see. Rav Kook is one of the main one of the main authorities who argues for the Heter Mechira. And the Chazon Ish, Rav Avraham Mishaya Karelitz, is one of the main rabbis who argues against the Heter Mechira, and they have it out on this issue as well that Jeffrey mentions as to whether or not this prohibition applies when we're doing it for our own benefit. So thank you for that. How much should we compare it to the other form of the prohibition of Chayin? Should we compare it to other prohibitions which are only exist if they're for the purpose of benefiting the non-Jew? There's a prohibition against Matnat Chinam, right, of giving a totally undeserved gift to non-Jews. But for instance, if you're doing it for also ulterior motives, you know, you can, you have the right to give, well, ask your local Orthodox rabbi, but if you have a coworker, you can give them a present if you think that will enhance your relationship, enable you to work with them more effectively, right? So do we compare it to that? These are all important discussions. So let's get to some of the other issues regarding the problem of selling the land to non-Jews. In source number 11, first, and this just lowers the stakes here, Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook argues that the whole prohibition nowadays is rabbinic. Meaning, even though, as the rabbis see it, there is a verse in the Torah prohibiting the sale of Eretz Yisrael to non-Jews, that only applied when Eretz Yisrael had its full status of Kedusha, of sanctity. However, since, according to many opinions, which we're relying on for this dispensation, the sanctity of Eretz Yisrael was abolished when the Jews lost the Second Temple and were exiled from the land, and therefore it no longer has its full status of Kedusha, so too the prohibition against selling the land of Israel to non-Jews does not have the same caliber. It's been lowered to a rabbinic prohibition. Now, we keep rabbinic prohibitions too, right? Like, they're also important. We keep, those are also things we have to be attention to. So it doesn't mean it's okay, but it at least lowers the stakes here. However, I think you could argue on Rav Kook's assertion here, because again, every single one of these arguments is debatable, right? So Rav Kook is comparing, say, the mitzvot, tliot ba'aretz, the mitzvot that directly relate to the land, like the produce, whether the produce is acceptable to Truma and Maaser and Shemitah, to the prohibition against selling the land to non-Jews. Do you think that's a fair comparison? Or is there room to disagree with Rav Kook here? What do you think? Why might you argue that although the sanctity of the land of Israel lowers the stakes of observing the mitzvot that has to do with the produce of the land of Israel, nevertheless, the prohibition against selling the land of Israel to non-Jews may still exist. How might? So let's think about this. Let me ask you, why is it? And I think this is the important issue, which relates to all the other discussions. Why is it that the Torah would have forbid the sale of the land of Israel to non-Jews? What's the goal behind that prohibition? What's wrong with selling? Yeah.
You should live there.
You should live there. Okay, that's one. We have to live there. Okay. No, what else? Besides that,
it takes away the mitzvahs of tluyim be'oritz for Yidden, right? Instead, the non-Jew is living there, and it takes away the potential doing of mitzvahs on those pieces of land.
Right. And, so Aaron mentions a very important point, which is another issue which discussed in the postgame, that maybe you can't, if you sell the land to a non-Jew, then that land will no longer be observed such that all the mitzvot related to the land of Israel will be performed, right? If we sell the land of Israel to a non-Jew, they're not going to keep Shemitah, they're not going to keep Truma, they're not going to keep Maaser. So that's also an important point. What about a general question of living amongst, let's say, idolatrous nations?
Yeah, I was saying you have influence, Rabbi. You're going to be influenced by them, badly influenced, but still, it's for a temporary period.
Ah, okay, good. So we get the temporary period, and great, we're getting all the issues here. So, but well, I think that Jeff's point is very relevant. Wait, just 1 second, Alan. So I think you could distinguish between the prohibition against selling the land to a non-Jew and taking Truma and Maaser. You're right, it doesn't have the same level of Kedusha, but the concern that we may be negatively influenced by those who live around us and be sort of exposed to idolatrous practices still exists, even if Eretz Yisrael doesn't have its full Kedusha. And if the point of the prohibition is that the Torah warns us against living in the presence of idolatrous nations in Eretz Yisrael, because we're living there, that might not be tied specifically to its level, the level of the sanctity of the land, right? So I think that Rav Kook is making a good point, but I don't know that it's for sure that he's correct on this. But it's an argument. Alan, do you want to add something?
Yeah, Rabbi, how about, it's also common in our tradition to, we see this in a lot, that non-Jews take a role in helping Jews, like over things that we see in Pesach. We sell our house to homets to a non-Jew. We see it in Shabbos with Goyes taking over Shabbos, selling your business to a Gentile so your business could be open on Saturday. We see it a lot that this performance of non-Jews is essential to keeping ourselves Jewish. like it's all from the oral tradition.
Right. I think you're making a lot of good points. Sewing Mechiras Chametz is a very interesting comparison. I think all those discussions need to be independently studied. But I think you're right. This is not the only time that we enlist the help of non-Jews in helping us observe our mitzvot. And I think there's a general ethic of, Mefarnsin on the Akam and Darkei Shalom. We want to be nice to non-Jews when we can. We want to promote peace in the world. But there are also specific prohibitions involved. So let's get to Jeffrey's point here. Assuming it is the Rabbanon, let's get to the point about temporary sales. If you look at source number 12, and this is a letter from Shmuel Salon to Yitzhak Hanan Inspector. So he argues that, look, we're talking about a temporary sale here, right? We're not talking about selling the land of Israel forever. It's for the Shemitah year. We're going to get it back. That's in the contract. So perhaps you could argue that it's not a violation of this prohibition of lo techanem, of allowing non-Jews to encamp in Eretz Israel when it's only on a temporary basis. Again, to Jeffrey's point, if the issue is influence, you might distinguish between someone who's going to be there forever or someone who's going to only be there for a year. If the purpose, if Rabbi Yaris is right, if what we're worried about is Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, that you are the one that's supposed to live there, maybe we can allow, 1 year of occupation by a non-Jew if we're going to get it back anyways. So that's part of the argument that's being presented here in source number 12. Maybe a temporary sale isn't susceptible to the prohibition of Lo Techane. However, it's not simple. It's not simple. And one reason it's not simple is because of source number 13. This is the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, where the Mishnah doesn't allow renting land in Israel to non-Jews. And I'll read you just the opinion of Rabbi Yossi, who we paskin like. If you look in the third line there in the English translation, in source number 13, Rabbi Yossi says, in Eretz Yisrael, one may rent houses to Gentiles, but one may not rent fields. So renting is by definition temporary. And yet there is a rabbinic prohibition, at least, against renting the land of Israel to non-Jews. So simply saying it's temporary doesn't necessarily alleviate the problem.
It says rent, you can sell it.
Ah, so Jeffrey, you're getting all the points here. I should have given you the mic. So Jeffrey mentions that renting and selling aren't the same, and there might be a bad, we have to analyze this carefully. There's a specific prohibition against selling, but that might be against selling it permanently. There's a specific prohibition against renting, but temporary sales aren't renting. And this is what Rav Yitzchak Cohen Cook argues for in source number 14. It appears that even though renting out land in the land of Israel is to a non-Jew is rabbinically forbidden, nevertheless, this decree doesn't include temporary sales because this isn't included in the prohibition against sales in the Torah. I see Rav Yitzchak Cohen Cook is making a very clear argument. He's having it both ways. A temporary sale is not a sale because it's not forever, but it's also not a rental because it's more than a rental. It's a temporary sale. Now, you could argue, but wait, I don't get it. If a rental where the non-Jew doesn't even achieve any real ownership of the land is prohibited, so certainly a temporary sale is going to be prohibited, where at least during the duration of the sale, they are the owners of the land. Like, why would you distinguish? Nevertheless, what Cook says, look, the rabbis forbid what they forbid. No need to expand that prohibition. And again, this obviously relates to the hashkafic approach of Rav Cook here, where he's saying, look, we have to find a way to make this work, and we're going to look for arguments to be lenient where we can find them. He says, therefore, we shouldn't innovate a decree ourselves, and we can say regarding an uncommon occurrence, the rabbis never decree. Generally, we say, milta d'lo shkicha lo gazer rabbanan. If there's something that doesn't happen regularly, so then the rabbis don't extend their prohibitions to those cases. So how often are people going to temporarily sell their land to a non-Jew? That's not so frequent. Come on. Now, you could say, but wait, Cook, you're making it pretty frequent. In fact, it's going to happen every 7 years. So this is a good point. But again, this is another argument to be lenient. Nevertheless, again, the Chazon Ish of Avram Yishai Karelitz, 20th century halachic decisor in post-secondary Israel is not very thrilled with this argument, as in general, he's not very thrilled with most of the arguments for Heter Mechir. In fact, the Chazon Ish, we mentioned the whole basis of the argument is that it's effective to sell the land to non-Jews. The Chazon Ish argues on that too and says, no, it's not effective. Even if the sale wasn't a good sale, if it was legal, you'd still be obligated all the mitzvot of Shemitah if it was the land of a non-Jew. But aside from that, Rav Chazon Ish says, even if you're right that the sale is enough to alleviate the concerns, a temporary sale is the same problem of Lo Techaneh. Says Rav Mishai Karelitz, there is no more temporary sale than selling a tree without land. Now getting into details here, the Gemara also mentions a problem, not just selling a house, not just selling an entire field, but even selling just a tree without any associated land. Now the halacha is, if you sell a tree without land, all the person owns is the tree. Well, let's think. How long is that sale going to last? As long as the tree survives. And once the tree's dead, there is no longer a sale. And yet, the rabbi said it's prohibited. So apparently, temporary sales aren't just allowed in terms of the isor, the prohibition against lo techanim. However, again, you know, you can argue both ways. You could distinguish between a sale which is by design temporary, right? Where it's in the contract that it's only going to be for a year, and the sale of a tree, which is for all intents and purposes permanent, it's just the tree ends up dying. That's the problem. It's not that we're saying I'm only selling it to you for 5 years. It's just that the tree's not going to last forever. So that's another issue number one in terms of lo techaneim. Maybe we can allow it because it's a temporary sale. There's another argument to be lenient here, and this relates to the nature of allowing non-Jews to live in Israel generally. And this is, again, a controversial topic, but it is pertinent to this discussion. So there's a term in halacha known as the ger toshav. I think that could be literally translated as resident alien. But the functional definition of ger toshav is as follows. As we mentioned, the purpose of living in the land of Israel and inhabiting and creating a community in the land of Israel is so that we can inhabit and live in Hashem's land and properly create a Torah society which functions according to Torah and mitzvot. Based on that, the Torah forbids the Jewish people from allowing people to live in Israel who do not abide by those guidelines. If someone is going to worship idolatry, or for that matter, as we paskin, reject any of the seven Noahide laws, you know, not killing or not stealing, or, you know, Avram and Achai eating from the flesh of a live animal, we cannot allow them to live in Israel. Those seven laws are so definitional that, you know, if you don't abide by them, you can't be a part of our society. Because we want to promote a Torah community. So what is the status of the non-Jews who live in Israel nowadays? That is part of the question. And there are two questions here to address. Number one, when we say that you are not allowed to sell the land of Israel to a non-Jew, does that specifically apply to a non-Jew who worships idolatry? Number one. Or is there an exemption for those who are gerei toshav, for those who inhabit the land of Israel and are what I would call kosher residents, who abide by the seven Noahide laws and therefore can be part of our community? Or is it a blanket prohibition against any sale of the land of non-Jews? I think, again, this goes back to the logic behind the prohibition. If the purpose of the prohibition is Rabbi Yaris described, which is we have to live in the land of Israel, it's our land. So it's harder than to make an exemption for a ger toshav. However, if the problem is that we're worried about foreign influence and inappropriate influence in our way of life, then it's possible, at least, that we can make an exemption for ger toshav. Okay? That's question one. Does the prohibition of lo techaneim apply to those who are kosher residents of Eretz Israel? But there's a second issue, and that is as follows. And I'd like to get some opinions on this, although you know, it's obviously controversial. What is the status of the non-Jews who live in Israel nowadays? Most of them, or many of them, are going to either be Christians or Muslims who do have a system of law and a system of religion. What is the status of those non-Jews who currently live in the land of Israel? What do you think?
I just want to go back, Rabbi, to your first point, the former point, and that is, well, how do you know if they're idol worshipers or not? I have to temporarily sell my field for a year. How in heck will I know who this guy prays to?
Great question. So I think I'll give you two answers, okay? There's the formal Gemara answer, and then there's the, you know, sort of practical modern answer. But where Cook is going to get this. So the first answer is that there was a formal process, and I should have mentioned this, thank you. There's a formal process of becoming a Ger Toshav. Meaning, it's not simply that we say, hey, you know, that woman looks like a very nice religious woman. She looks kosher. She's a, you know, she's a, she can be a Gioret Toshav. I guess that's the proper term. I think Shini will correct me afterward. Not sure. But so that's okay. No, that's not how it works. When Beis Din functions and we have full authority, it means a formal process of standing in front of a court and saying, I accept the seven Noahide laws and I am going to be a Ger Toshav. It's a formal acceptance in front of a Beis Din, sort of like the process that a convert goes through when they convert to Judaism generally and accept all 613 mitzvot. It's a semi-conversion of some sort. It can be thought of as that way. Now, as we're about to read, we don't really do that nowadays, right? We don't have Bate Dinim as we had them. We don't have Jewish courts nowadays accepting Ger Toshav. We accept full-fledged converts, but not partial converts. However, there's another notion, which is, well, what if it's really about not the formal category of Ger Toshav, but rather simply knowing that they don't worship idolatry, then if there's an entire religion founded on the basis of not worshiping idolatry, who the entire monotheistic religion, the chazaka, the general, the going assumption is that they don't worship idolatry. That's their whole religion. So, you know, and I guess we'll say, you know, as it's a more complicated conversation in regard to Christianity. I'm not going to go again into that now, exactly what the status of Christianity is in halacha for Jewish people who may convert to Christianity, for Christians themselves, as to whether or not we consider that idolatry for Gentiles. It's a loaded discussion, but specifically for Islam, which is a monotheistic religion, maybe we can rely on the fact that their religion is such that they don't worship idolatry. Okay.
Can't we focus, and I'm sorry if you already addressed this, but the idea of Lotatilam Chaniya Bekarka implies that had you not done this, they would not have Chaniya Bekarka. But here, they're already living there, and therefore, whatever you do, they're still living in their homes, and it's not impacting their Chaniya whatsoever.
Excellent point. So this is another issue that is raised in the post-game that the Chaz Mishnah of Cook argue about. Chaim says, look, if the problem is that they're, you know, that we can't give them, quote unquote, chanaya bekarka, the opportunity to live in Israel, what if they already live there? So some, again, argue that since we already have non-Jews living in the land of Israel, so they're already there. We're not allowing a new opportunity for them to live in Israel. They live there already. Maybe they get a little bit more land for a year, but that's not the prohibition against chanaya bekarka. However, again, there are others who argue that no, that it's not just about generally living in the land. It's about this land. This specific land was under Jewish ownership and was possessed by Jewish people who, again, were keeping mitzvot tliya ba'aretz and were keeping chuma and meiser. Now you're giving it to a non-Jew. And some bring the proof from the fact that when we entered Eretz Yisrael and there are seven nations that inhabited the land, we didn't say, well, they're already there. So no problem with giving them more land. No, we said, we got to get the land. But there are arguments, again, back and forth regarding that proof and that issue. But thank you. That is absolutely a relevant point to this discussion. But what about Ger Toshav? So if you look in source 16, we have a dispute. And I see I'm already running out of time. So I'll try to be a bit more liberal in terms of reading inside. A dispute between the Rambam and the Ravid here. Or at least what appears to be a dispute. The Rambam says, if you look at the bold at least, a Ger Toshav may be accepted only in the era when the laws of the Jubilee year are observed. In an era when the laws of the Jubilee year are not observed, however, we accept only full converts to Judaism. Meaning the Rambam says, based on a drasha, a teaching of the sages, that we can no longer accept these sort of partial converts nowadays, that we no longer have Yovel, and we no longer, and therefore we can't accept Gerei Tosha or Gerim Toshavim. The Ravid, Rav Avram Ibn David, who wrote a series of comments in the Rambam in which he takes issue with the Rambam, writes as follows. I disagree with him regarding living in the land. So the way Rav Cook interprets this Ravid as follows. First he says, look, what the Ravid's saying is, I understand, Rambam, you might be telling me that you can't have a full-fledged Geret Hosham nowadays because of the lack of Beis Din and the lack of Yovel. That's fine. But that doesn't mean you can't allow non-Jews to buy land in Israel. Maybe you don't need the formal status of Geret Hosham to allow the sale of Israel to a non-Jew. Maybe all you require is the reliance on the fact that they don't worship idolatry. There's only certain halachot that you need full third Geret Hosham. A Geret Hosham, a kosher resident, we'll call them, is full. We fully support her. We have to take care of them as we would a Jew. We give them tzedakah as you would a Jew. They have almost full status in the community. And that's what we're saying. In order to achieve that, you need to be a full-fledged Geret Hosham. But just to allow them to live among us, simply the knowledge that they're not going to worship idolatry is sufficient. At first, he says, it seems like the Rambam would argue, but the Rav Yosef Karo comments on this. Rambam says even the Rambam really agrees to this as well. It wasn't necessarily an argument about allowing people who don't worship idolatry to live in the land of Israel. So if you argue that, number one, there is no prohibition against selling the land of Israel to a Geret Hosham, or at least to a type of non-Jew who doesn't, who's monotheistic and doesn't worship idolatry, and you argue that the current Gentiles who live in the land of Israel fulfill one of those two categories, we can then alleviate the problem of selling the land of Israel to non-Jews. The Chazon Ish, again, doesn't like this argument either. First of all, he says the Rambam disagrees, and he says even the Ravid, even Rav Avraham Ibn David, wasn't talking about anyone who says, I don't worship idolatry. That's not enough, because beyond simply right bowing down to the sun or the moon or stars, there are other beliefs which run counter to the fundamental beliefs of Judaism. And for the Chazon Ish, a Geret Hosham isn't simply, and this is a discussion in the Rambam, he makes distinction between Chassidei Umot HaOlam, the pious of the nations of the world, and Chachameim, the wise of the nations of the world. But the Chazon Ish argues that to be a Geret Hosham, it's not sufficient to sort of by chance keep the seven Noahai laws because you think that's just basic human decency. You have to accept the fact that the Jewish people were given the Torah at Sinai, and just as they were commanded to observe the 613 mitzvot, you, as a Geret Hosham, are commanded to observe the seven mitzvot, because that's what Hashem commanded you at Sinai. It has to be based on the belief in the Torah. And as we know, the other monotheistic religions, although they are monotheistic, reject the fact that the Torah is still binding as we have it. And that's also, in terms of the concern of foreign influence, is also a problem, because if we live among people who reject that the Torah is binding, that also might expose us to these heretical beliefs. So that's another argument which has two sides to it. Okay, what about the fact that just generally, if Shemitah is rabbinic, and observing Shemitah will result in the loss of a lot of money and the parnassah, the sustenance of the farmers in Israel, does that allow any room for leniency in and of itself? And this relates to the problem raised earlier, and I'm forgetting who, in terms of the fact that the Israeli government now owns most of the land. If you look in source number 19, excuse me, there is a certain dispensation referred to as Arnona. I know I'm running out of time, so I'll just reference these sources briefly. But the Gemara says that Rabbi Yonath claims, go out, sow the fields during the sabbatical year, due to thee, Arnoa. You can go and work the field during Shmita because of Arnona. What is Arnona? Rashi explains that it's a tax the king collected from the grain at a certain volume every single year. So basically, the farmers of the land of Israel have to pay this tax to the government. And because they need to be able to pay that tax, whether or not they produce, you know, anything during that year, they had the right to work the land in order to pay that tax. Rashi himself is unclear whether or not this is simply a, you know, challenge in terms of paying taxes in and of itself, or there's a greater threat of what might happen, of pikuach nefesh, of the loss of lives, if we refuse to pay this type of tax to the government. Tosfot has two different opinions on this. One is that this is only allowed because it's literal pikuach nefesh, it's the saving of lives, and that's what allowed the Rav Yonai and the Gemara to tell these people to work the land during Shemitah, whereas the second one is a lot more lenient. It says simply, since Shemitah is only rabbinic, and there is a potential difficulty in the kingdom or the government demanding money that we might not be able to provide, even if it doesn't result in the loss of lives, they were lenient in order to pay the government the taxes they are demanding. Based on this Gemara, Moshe Netrani, the Mabit, who on the one hand is very strict in many Shemitah issues, says that if we are governed by a foreign non-Jewish government, we have the right, and even if it's not the greatest problem, even if it's simply they want taxes, they're demanding it from you, they're not necessarily going to do anything horrible, but that the very demand itself is enough to justify working the land because Shemitah is, again, Dirabana. However, should that apply nowadays? Because nowadays we aren't governed by a foreign government. And if there are taxes, it's a Jewish, although secular, a Jewish government demanding them. So for the government to demand real estate taxes and make us work during Shemitah, I don't know. That doesn't seem to be a very good dispensation. So why should that be allowed? So Rav Yechiel Michal Tukachinsky in his Sefer Shemitah says, well, maybe that no longer applies. However, maybe we could argue that the very fact that we need to continue working the land and sustaining the people in the land of Israel economically, because our enemies sort of try to prevent us from profiting and they besiege us and they like sort of interfere with our exports, at least in his time, the very survival based on our finances is also a sort of pikuach nefesh. It's a very serious situation in and of itself, even though nowadays we are governed by a Jewish government. I see that I'm running out of time, so we'll have to lead out the last issue of sinful agency. But sort of in conclusion here, let me make two more points. Number one is that Rav Yosef Tzvi Rimon mentions that nowadays things have changed to a certain extent. We have a much more formal sale. As mentioned, the government is involved in the sale. It's very serious. There's a contract that's presented to the farmers. They look it over. They show it to their lawyers. So there's also less of an issue of the legal fiction issue, which is, look, no one's taking this seriously anyway. We know it's just to not, you know, have to keep Shemitah. No one really would. Who in the world would agree to sell the entire land of Israel to non-Jews? No one would agree to that. Nowadays, there's a lot more force and seriousness to it. However, Rav Kook mentions that although I argue for this dispensation, I think it's necessary to allow the Jews to continue to live in the land of Israel, we should, first of all, prevent people or withhold from doing biblical forms of work, because that's a more serious prohibition. And therefore, whenever possible, we should ask non-Jewish workers to do the work for us, because that's a less serious prohibition. As I understand it, nowadays, often there are non-Jewish workers doing those types of work anyway, which on the one hand is unfortunate because we're giving the jobs to non-Jews. We don't necessarily, you know, trust in the same way, but helps in terms of Shemitah. But nevertheless, the situation continues to change. The financial situation continues to change. And therefore, if Cook argues for renegotiating and rethinking the Heter Mechira every single year. And so I think on the whole, and again, there's much more to talk about, but the notion of Heter Mechira studies the question of what it means to live in the land of Israel nowadays and to form a country in the land of Israel nowadays, and how we can grapple with the difficulties and realities of living in the land, and also strive as best as we can to keep the halacha. May we all be able to return to the land of Israel soon, keep the halacha in its best form, and keep the laws of Shemitah all, their halachot, and experience the final redemption that Rav Kook promised us is going to come so soon after we all return to the land of Israel. Thank you so much for joining. Please feel free to join our, if you want to, our email list for our Friday share, which is always about Shemitah every single week. And for any other programs that you're interested in, we can add you to any of those email lists. And have a wonderful day and a wonderful family day.